Let me announce what the lecture title is, which is the Homeric concept of noos, mind, and nospos, return in the Odyssey. Both words come from the same root, and what interests us most about this connection between mind and return is that this means that the whole concept of nospos, which we talked about the last time, the return of the hero, the reintegration of the hero in the homeland, that concept is mental. That there's something mental about the mechanics of return and the mechanics of the song of return. Here's the way I define noos in number one. This is a tough word to define, which is why I love to give it to you always in the original Greek. I never try to dumb down the word for you because it's just too elusive if we say mind or any other translation. So here are my translations. That it designates the realm of consciousness, of rational functions, if you like, intuition, perception. And then one of the most mystical aspects of noos, there comes a special moment, you might call it the right time and the right place, and at that special moment, noos, whatever this mental ability is, can reintegrate your thumos and your psyche after death. Now, thumos is what you either feel with, it's what you feel emotions with, but it's also what you think with. It's both your rational and your emotional faculties. And a lot of times people translate it as heart. Not so much the organ that goes thump, thump, but the seat of emotions. In Greek, however, when Sappho talks about her heart, it's not just emotional, it's rational. In English, it's 99% emotional, 1% rational, heart. Can you think of the rational context of heart when you say, I've learned it by heart? Then it's rational, but 99% of the time it's emotional. So I'm saying that this concept, thumos, what you think with and what you feel with, is something that is triggered by noos, this word that's so difficult to translate. And then this other word, psyche, gives you so many headaches in Homeric poetry because it's such a restricted word in Homeric poetry. Have you noticed that people who are alive can't think and can't feel with their psyche? That only happens later in the 5th century. In Homeric Greek, psyche is simply the life force within you, what makes you live and breathe. And when you die, it leaves you, and then it becomes, remember, a disembodied conveyor of identity after death. But when you're alive, as when Achilles is alive, and he says, I'm alive, damn it, and I don't want to lose my psyche. It's the most precious thing to me, he says at one point. This psyche is almost like a split personality in Homeric poetry, because, as I say, nowhere in Homeric poetry does a hero think or feel with a psyche. You do it with your thumos, which I'm sort of, what can I do? I'm translating that as heart, even though heart is misleading. So anyway, thumos and psyche are difficult enough, but then there's this even more difficult word, noos, which is that mental whatever that makes everything come together again at some specially right time and right place, which will turn out to be mystical, and you have to get initiated into it, and it's not something that's obvious. And let me repeat, this: I can't repeat this enough, I can't return to this enough, that nospos, the concept of returning home, is mental, and the mentality of that is what noos, this related word, is all about. In numbers 2 and 3, what I'm telling you is that in the beginning of the Odyssey, both of these words come into play immediately. In Odyssey Verse 3, Odysseus saw the cities of many and came to know, look at my translation, there, his, noos. The original Greek doesn't say whether it's there or his, and we have to infer which one it is. And then look at number 3, just a little bit later on at the beginning of the Odyssey, Odysseus is described as the hero who is seeking to win as a prize, as his ultimate goal, his own psyche. What does that mean? That's like winning your life or winning back your life. But is it really life or is it the disembodied conveyor of identity after death? What is it? And that's not all. He's struggling to win as a prize both that and his own nostos, his own homecoming, plus as an afterthought that of his companions. You see how complex the Odyssey is in comparison to the Iliad with its monolithic either-or propositions, its uncompromising hero. And look what's sandwiched in between, which I give you in number 4 of the handout, how Odysseus suffered many argia, pains. And this is the word that we see in scientific ways of describing painkillers like aspirin. Analgesic is anti-pain. And what fascinates me, number 5, this is a modern concept, but it uses ancient Greek components. Think of the word nostalgia. Nostalgia is a combination of the Odyssean concept of nostos, homecoming, and algos, or algea, sorrows, pains, sad thoughts. And we certainly saw a lot of nostalgia in this deep mystical sense in that mystical film by Kieślowski, The Double Life of Veronique, where at crucial times, this young woman, let's call her Veronica II, kept thinking back of a return. What I like about that film, among many things, is the mentality of return, that it's a mental process again. I think it's in this context that it would be good for us, too, to return. Number 5b, and I'm using a concept that is a special favorite of French literature, to return to the lost time of the Iliad, now that we're in the Odyssey. Can I just quickly revisit those specific verse numbers, because all of them are focused on your reading of the Odyssey and help your reading of the Odyssey. In line 326, there's this singer of songs at the court of Odysseus while Odysseus is absent, and he is singing an epic which is called the Nostos of the Achaeans, because there was a song tradition for the homecoming of every one of the Achaeans who fought at Troy, which is the last, or should I say, the latest Nostos. It's the one that's still in progress, if I can speak in terms of a medium program, because the Nostos of Odysseus in Odyssey Scroll 1 is still in progress, and the outcome is still in doubt. But that's why it's very important that in the micro-narrative of the singer of tales is singing a song of homecoming of Achaeans in general. It's kind of a generic Nostos. And what happens? Penelope hears it from upstairs and starts crying uncontrollably. She comes down and she comes downstairs and tells the singer, stop that singing, because that singing may be epic entertainment for the suitors, these nasty young men who are trying to marry her and essentially deprive the returning king of his kingdom. It may be just an epic entertainment for those suitors, but for me, it's something much more personally involving. It's a penthos holaston. It's a sorrow that cannot be forgotten. And you, as initiates, already know that penthos is not just sorrow. It's sorrow as conveyed by a song of lamentation. That is to say, if you're personally involved in something sad, what you sing about it is different than simply telos, which could be just epic entertainment. Could be. You have this deeper involvement because your own life and your own nearest and dearest are involved. And that's why for her, it's an epic. For them, it's... Let's try that again. For her, it's a lamentation. For them, it's an epic. Now, I would say that they're having a very superficial reading of epic, the kind that I'm trying to guide you away from, because they think it's just about swashbucklers coming back home from Troy. But the epic of the Iliad and the Odyssey itself has lament, the songs of lament woven into it, as we see precisely from the tears of Penelope, how she sings, and as you have discussed in section when you looked at the third song of the blind singer at the court of the Phaeacians in Odyssey Scroll 8. Then it turns out that the son of Odysseus, Telemachus, who is still clueless, who still does not yet have the mental, the moral, and the emotional faculties to understand, to get it, Telemachus rebukes his mother, saying, "Mother, let the singers sing the songs. This is epic, and you don't understand what epic is all about. Epic is about kleos." And he goes on to say, and here his own micro-narrative is undermined by the macro-narrative of the Odyssey. He says at verse 351, "People love to hear the latest kleos, the latest kleos." And Telemachus is still too out of it to understand that the latest kleos is the kleos of Odysseus in the making. So in other words, there's a deeper meaning, there's a more superficial meaning, depending on whether you understand the agenda of the macro narrative, and those agenda can only be understood if you understand the song of the weeping woman. Telemachus may be out of it in Scroll 1. By the time he gets to Scroll 4, he's practically fully initiated. He has already evolved mentally, morally, and emotionally to such a point that he really understands what his father's kleos is all about, because he has tracked all the algea, all the sufferings of the father, as he keeps inquiring from one witness of the epic events of the Tales of Troy to another. And by the time we get to Scroll 4, Telemachus is so connected that every time he hears his father's name, he starts breaking down and weeping. So then how do you figure that Helen of Troy, who is the hostess in Odyssey Scroll 4, can get away with what she does in that part of the Odyssey? Do you remember how Helen says to Telemachus, who is her guest, and to her husband, Menelaus, who after all was one of the protagonists of the Trojan War, she says, "Sit back, relax, I'm going to tell you a rousing kleos about the adventures of the Achaeans at Troy." And you say, "Wait a minute, this is not going to work," you say to yourself, because all of these people are personally involved. Even Telemachus, who now understands the sufferings and pains of his father, even he is involved. So how can she say that? Well, she says that after having laced their drinks. Helen puts a drug into the drink of Telemachus, of Menelaus, and all those people to whom she's talking when she's saying, "Sit back, relax, I'll perform an epic for you about the tale of Troy." That drug is described, I'm still at 5b, and this is Scroll 4, line 220, that drug is described as nepenthes, which means anti-penthos, counteracting penthos. And the narrative goes on to describe nepenthes as the kind of drug that, when you take it, you blank out completely emotionally, that your heart, at least the emotional side, blanks out. So much so that even if you had your nearest and dearest killed in front of your eyes, you would look at it and say, "That's a very good epic entertainment." That's the way it's described. So we're trying to get away from this kind of superficial reading, if you will, of epic, and try to see the component of lamentation and love song, a component that is generated mostly by the women of the society. And that has to do and I'm going to concentrate even more with tears, with weeping, with laments. Virgil, who was one of the greatest scholars of Greek civilization, even though we think of him only as a Roman poet, says it beautifully in the Aeneid. If I may borrow from Roman literature, look at 5c. This is where Aeneas, who is a survivor of the Trojan Holocaust, is looking, he's at Carthage now, so he's far away from Troy, and he's looking at these gates, and on these gates is a relief that portrays, in visual format, all the sufferings, if I may say it Homerically, all the Argeia of Troy. And he breaks down and weeps, which is when Dido notices this, the queen of Carthage, and look what happens to her. She falls hopelessly in love with him. So here again, lament and love song go together, eroticism and lament go together. But this time it's the man who's weeping, and this is where you have one of the greatest lines in Latin literature, and one of the hardest to translate. Sunt lacrimae rerum. I've never found a good literal translation of this, because can I tell you what it means in Latin? It means there are tears, and then it says of things. What does it mean, of things? Well, when you learn Latin grammar, you find out that the least common denominator for the genitive case, you don't want me to talk about grammar forever, but as a linguist, I think that there is a poetics of grammar, so I love grammar. The least common denominator of the genitive case is to express connection. I've given you a $10 word last time we met for meaning by way of connection. What is it? Metonymy. You remember metonymy, where you express meaning by way of connecting? And what I tell my students in both Greek and Latin, when they say, what's the least common denominator for the genitive? I say, when you don't know how to translate it and everything else fails, translate it as in connection with. So it doesn't sound very poetic, but can I do it here? There are tears in connection with things. The implication is that the whole universe has things connected with it that evoke tears. That's why I like the beginning of Blade Runner, where you see this giant eye taking in the world of modernity with all its sufferings, and there are flames of industrial waste reflected in the eye, and the eye is suffused with tears. So this says everything. This in capsule form says everything that nostalgia is about, that the themes of Noos and Nostos are about, because the Odyssey is a retrospective. And I'm trying to get you really in the mood for tonight's film, which I hope as many of you can see as possible. It's called Map of the Human Heart. This is why I've been harping on the concept of heart. And this is about an Inuit boy who becomes, I use the English cliche, a war hero in World War II. And he becomes a bomber pilot. And he goes on 20 bombing missions, survives each one of them. He's a real survivor. And then, because of a jealous husband, there's lots of unrequited love here, he gets sent on mission number 21. Now, because he comes from a song culture and a shamanistic culture, which is what Noos and Nostos are all about, where he can see things as a crow does when the crow flies from away from him towards distant lands, and he can see from the point of view of the flying bird, just as if the bird could fly back, and there his mentality is suffused with all this knowledge. This shamanistic warrior is in love with a woman who isn't quite reciprocating his love. And he remembers the woman as a little girl because they were both tuberculosis patients in a hospital. And already in the hospital, this little Inuit boy is trying to understand the little girl by looking at an x-ray of the little girl, because shamanism is not only a question of going on vision quests where your soul travels to worlds not yet traveled and then comes back. Shamanism also is looking inside the real human and seeing what really makes them tick. The heart in a visceral way. It's not just the organ that goes thump, thump, but the whole work. It's looking inside the chest. And so he's already been studying this little girl's heart ever since they were children by holding on to the x-ray that he steals from the hospital. But now he's a grown warrior, and he is going on his 21st mission. He's saying goodbye to this woman that he loves, and about whose love he is not quite certain. And at that point, he takes out the x-ray, and he puts it next to her chest. But this is the x-ray of a little girl, not the woman who is saying goodbye to him now. Then he goes off on this mission. I'd like to elaborate on what the mission is. During World War II, everybody likes to hate the Germans for all the terrible things they did in World War II, but there was a questionable moment in World War II when the Allied forces firebombed a civilian city that had no military importance. This is Dresden, or Dresden. And what we're going to see is how this Inuit warrior, on his 21st bombing run, is flying over Dresden. And he has the x-ray of the little girl, who's now a grown woman. And then there's this hellish vision of war. He gets shot down. Then he gets to see the whole war from the point of view of people on the ground. And the MC, we're going to stop when we go from the red to the blue, because suddenly we'll flash forward to the Arctic coolness, which is all blue. But this is an amazing sequence, just one moment of many great moments in tonight's film at 8 o'clock. So shall we roll it?
I'll never let you go. Give me your head. Did I break it? Give it to me again.
I have to go. Wrong hand. This is my trigger finger. Thank you.
Christ, it's cold in here. I'll get you out. Come on. I can't. My legs.
An amazing journey of a soul, if I can put it in Odyssey in terms. I hope you come and see it, because among other things, it's one of the most wonderful ways to learn how to read metonyms. Did you notice how the X-ray at that moment melted in the heat? And it's at that moment that he rescues the little girl who happens to be just there as one of the war victims. I also like this moment because since the Germans were the villains in World War II, it reminds us of the way Achilles feels about Hector in Iliad 24, and what a difficult thing it is for Achilles at the very end of the Iliad to come to terms with the father of somebody that he hated more than anybody in the world because of the killing of his nearest and dearest. Yes.
Wasn't Achilles on the German side symbolically?
No, I think Achilles is on the Allies' side, so to speak. I think we now think of Hector and the Trojans as the good guys, so to speak, but not in terms of the song culture. Look, you know, I have this wonderful debate with all of you over and over again, which is, I know we're all sympathetic to Hector, but what I continually come back to is that we cannot understand Hector if we don't already understand that this song culture thinks that Achilles is the ultimate doomed bridegroom. Come tonight and you will see how the doomed bridegroom in this case is definitely on the Allies' side and not on the German side. So see for yourself, and we can debate further. But right now, the most important thing is that we're not looking at the Iliad as the Iliad. We're looking at it retrospectively. We're looking at it from the point of view of the hero who did burn Troy and who succeeded in capturing Troy where the hero of the Iliad did not. And yet the irony of ironies is that Odysseus, whose brains made it possible for Troy to be destroyed, is not the star of the Song of Troy, which is Iliad. The star of the Song of Troy is the person who failed to capture Troy. And that's not a man of brains, it's more a man of brawn. If I can oversimplify, and that's Achilles. Remember again what I said about Virgil, and there are tiers of things, and the metonymy of tiers connected to everything that the lens of epic is looking at. And the way connections of sorrow, as we saw in this clip here, go from, let's say, sorrow to love, or from love to sorrow, especially as expressed by women. I told you at the beginning of this hour, when you came in, you were listening to that aria from Puccini. To keep the melody in your mind, I'm giving you here, number 7, the actual words of the aria that you heard. And it's not maybe the greatest poetry you ever heard, but it's a lovelorn girl who is protesting to her father, who doesn't want this affair of the daughter to continue. And look what the girl threatens to do. I like him, he's beautiful, beautiful. I'm on my way going to the Porta Rossa to buy the wedding ring. Yes, yes, I want to go there. And if I love him in vain, I will go to the old bridge, but only to throw myself into the Arno. This is the river in Florence, which is the setting for Gianni Schicchi. And I struggle and I'm tormented. Oh God, I want to die. So you have this unrequited love, you have the themes of death, and it's this kind of sentimentality, so to speak, that on a deeper level can become the material of lament. And this is the way we have to understand the descent of Odysseus to the lower world, to Hades, which is where he meets a nous, an intellect, who can tell him how to make it back up to the world of the living. That's number 8 and number 9 on the handout. And there again you see the connectedness of this special kind of mentality, nous, and then the theme of return. Return not just from Troy back to Ithaca, not just from war to peace, but also from Hades to the realm of the living. You can see that symbolism in the root that forms both of these words, number 10, which, if I had to translate it as briefly as possible, would mean something like return to light and life. And what you have to imagine, I'm going to draw you a map of the world from a Homeric point of view. Our world is, of course, round and flat, and it is surrounded by a cosmic freshwater river called the ocean, or Okeanos. The idea that ocean is seawater happens much later, in the 6th century. And if you imagine this being west, and this being east, every time the sun... What did I do? I'm already anticipating what will happen in the next 5 minutes, as you'll see. Sorry about that. Every time the sun sets in the far west, and if you turn your handout over to the other page, number 13, every time the sun sets, the way Homeric poetry describes it is that the solar disk actually plunges into this freshwater river, the Okeanos. And every time the sun rises, it comes out of that same freshwater river the morning after. Um, And what is amazing about this is when you think about the journey of the soul of Odysseus, if I can put it that way. All right, let's put it another way. The descent of Odysseus to Hades, as he tells the story from scrolls 9 through 11, you will see that he has been coming further and further and further west. And then eventually he reaches this place where there's no more sea, it's just the fresh water encircling the universe. He crosses that fresh water, he goes down to Hades. And you can tell from the trajectory of his travels, although there are lots of zigzags, that he's been going from essentially east to west. He enters Hades. Then one of the most miraculous things, one of the most mystical things of the Odyssey, when he comes back out of Hades at the beginning of Book 12, the way it's described is he comes back to the Okeanos, the freshwater spring, the freshwater river that surrounds the universe. But this time, Okeanos in the beginning of Book 12 is described as being where the sun rises and the dawn goddess dances. In other words, somehow while he was in Hades, just as the sun manages to go from far west to far east again overnight, so also Odysseus in his travel to Hades has managed to retrace the path of the sun. And he comes out of his sojourn in Hades, this journey of a soul to hell, so to speak, on the other side. As your grandmother used to say, what goes around, comes around. This amazing return, may I call it Anostos, retraces the return of the sun every time the sun rises. And is, are you ready? I told you I would keep using the words metonym and metaphor over and over again from now on. Is a metaphor, say this return is a metaphor for what you and I would call, I suppose, consciousness. Because listen, every time we pass out and we come to again, essentially there's a return of our consciousness. And that return of the consciousness is viewed in this tradition as retracing the path of the sun, sunset back to sunrise. And that is what Odysseus does on a deeper level in his journey of a soul, or may I say, journey of a psyche, which is the goal of his odyssey. That's the ultimate goal. Ithaca is the goal on the surface, the homecoming. But underneath the surface is this very, very deep metaphor of rising the way the sun rises at sunrise. And you see it all coming together. Not just the plot of the Odyssey, but the meaning of nous and nostos, consciousness and return, at the precise moment that Odysseus makes it back to Ithaca. This is one of the most mystical moments of the Odyssey. I give you the full text in number 14. But before I even rehearse what's happening there, could I just say that we've already seen that nous is what makes the difference between being alive versus being dead, of being awake instead of being asleep. I like to put it better this way, of being conscious instead of being unconscious. And in that sense, nous is the prototype of what you and I would call the enlightenment of the human mind. When I say enlightenment, am I not using a metaphor that's not very different from the giant metaphor that operates the Odyssey? What happens at the precise moment that Odysseus's ship reaches Ithaca is that he is asleep. And the ship is traveling at night. And at the precise moment that the ship finally reaches Ithaca, guess what happens? The morning star rises, heralding the appearance of the dawn goddess. So day from night. And at that moment, Odysseus wakes up. And at that moment, a new consciousness, a real return happens. And the synchronization, and this Course on Heroes is all about synchronization, is how the precise pinpoint moment, the right time and right place of sunrise, corresponds to the hero's waking up after his journey to the dead, after his journey to the infernal, hellish regions where he has to resist the idea of staying in the Holocaust, so to speak, of Troy, and getting on with life and reintegrating his life in the city at peace, which will be Ithaca. But he still has a long way to go in once he actually makes it to the island. Now, notice how I got confused and I had my east and my west wrong. That was almost good because Odysseus has so many false starts. My favorite false start has to do with a pseudo-Ithaca that he reaches earlier. And I give it to you at the top of page 11. And he thinks it's Ithaca, and then he realizes it isn't, and he goes down from the summit to tell his people that I was wrong, this is not Ithaca. At that point, they start weeping uncontrollably. They weep uncontrollably because Odysseus has told them that he no longer knows where the sun rises and the sun sets, which is pretty much what I reenacted for you with my scrambling of west and east. He no longer knows what is east and west. What do we call that? He is, are you ready for our metaphor? He is disoriented. He has lost his orientation. And, you know, the only thing that people can think of when they're feeling disoriented in the Odyssey is the most horrible moments of the war at Troy. And that is quintessentially symbolized in the ability of one human not only to be brutal to another, but to be ready to cannibalize the other human. So the cannibals of the Odyssey are a kind of nightmarish and retrospective return to the world of the Iliad, where people get so brutal, so brutalized by war, that they're ready to eat raw their opponents. As Achilles says, as he's standing over the corpse of Hector. Well, I want to end with a 30-second clip, Yancy. So it's the 30-second clip. And, you know, on your website, I hope you will revisit this clip. But it has to do with a sculptor's vision. It has to do with this all-black regiment that, for the most part, died in the Civil War. And they're actually celebrated in this building. Think of Memorial Hall as a SEMA. And the warriors who were marching along with Robert Gould Shaw to their doom, whose skin happens to be black, have been memorialized. Go ahead. This is good.
It took St. Gaudens 14 years to finish the monument. The precision of his design is evident on the summer solstice. When the sun sets behind Beacon Hill, the last rays of light fall only on the faces of Shaw and his soldiers.
And what you see here, in this moment, everything comes together at summer solstice. In a sense, the psyche of the warriors who are going to their doom, the psyche is lit up by the last rays of the sun. And as Charles Ives puts it, this is the way I want to end, you images of God, the last lines of 21, you images of God carved in ebony, a shadow of a sad heart, never light abandoned, moving, marching faces of souls. Or as we would say in Greek, psychai, journeys of souls. Thank you.